ladies and gentlemen. Fasten your seatbelts.
Yes, fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride. You've got double trouble as the economy collapses, along with the climate we humans have known for 10,000 years. Outgoing President Bush is exercising his scorched earth policy as he slides out the door. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. The news is pouring in with changes too big for the imagination. In this program, you'll hear a quick clip from Barack Obama, his climate promises. A Toronto professor explains the links between the economy and natural crashes. Then our feature presentation, the latest climate science from NASA's James Hansen and Tom Helwig Larson of the Public Interest Research Center. They testified to the Environmental Audit Committee in the United Kingdom on Wednesday, November 26th. The climate news is horrific. As George Monbiot wrote in the Guardian newspaper, we may already be too late.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going through a bit of turbulence. The captain has illuminated the seatbelt signs. We do ask that you return to your seats, fasten your seatbelts, and please do not use the lavatory. Thank you.
I'll recap Hansen and Helwig Larson with lots of clips in less than 24 minutes and point you to a free download of the full audio. First, I want to quickly cover the Bush scorched earth policy, as I call it, and our hopes for a recovered planet. Is it Sunday? I think I'll spend $326 billion buying toxic assets from Citigroup. Exactly what I promised not to do just a couple of weeks ago. This from the CNN Lou Dobbs Show.
If we do not correctly diagnose the causes and instead act in haste to implement more rather than better regulations, we can do long-term harm.
The sums are just unbelievable. $3, $4, $5 trillion. That goes where? What impact is that having? Why do we have to spend that money? Meanwhile, middle-class families are worrying, how do I stay warm this winter? How do I send my kids to college?
Sunday has become the day when capitalism buries its dead. Miraculously, these American icons are raised anew with the magic wand of imaginary money from future taxpayers, the colossal loans that will eat up your paycheck if you still have one. Paulson hopes the rescue money will come from totalitarian countries like China and Saudi Arabia, who don't like us very much. How bad is it when a vegetable farmer in Platteville, Colorado, opened up his fields for free food? 40,000 people descended like locusts, cleaning out tons of veggies in just hours.
New tonight, Fox 31's Kristen Ayers is live from the farm. Kristen?
40,000 people and more than 500,000 pounds of food given away in mere hours.
Today was crazy.
People from all over Colorado jammed Miller Farms today, taking all the vegetables they could carry.
For us, this was very important because we have a rather large family.
Sean Thomas's family took away 70 pounds of food, 10 for each family member.
This will help us for a while.
Workers at the farm said the giveaway came just in time for the holidays.
Food banks are full of hungry people and going broke at the same time. Every informed prediction I've found, not from cranks, but experts and the financial press, warn we are just entering this new depression. The big layoffs, like the 52,000 from Citicorp, are just the beginning.
Hey kids, welcome to deflation. The credit crunch is something that is gonna change the nation. We'll short the fatted markets today, so stick around. You're gonna see some bankrupted companies, stocks tumbling down. Billy and Donnie, have you seen him yet? Whoa, but they're so spaced out. Betty and the feds. The banks out isn't wonderful. Oh, Betty, it's worse than it seems. They've got the policy for the economy. You know, I saw it on CNBC. Whoa, whoa, Betty and the Feds.
That That was Benny and the Feds, available on YouTube. The artist is the Jazz for Peace man, Rick Delarata. Rick has organized jazz jams all over the world to help both peace and the environment. Just check out jazzforpeace.org.
Our moment in human history, I would argue, is the big bonfire. You can think of our predicament or our situation as 6 billion humans around an enormous flame. We're piling on about 1 million tons of fossil fuels every hour. Producing, when you burn those fuels, you're producing about 80 million tons of CO2 a day. Some of it will still be there 100 years. A portion of it will still be there 500 years from now.
That's Randy Udall from the Peak Moment TV. Google that one for some of the best coverage of peak oil. Peakmoment.tv. Now on to the climate, the only show that matters. There is a close link between this economic breakdown and the exhaustion of nature by industrialized humans. Here's another clip sent in by a Radio EcoShock listener, John Paul Warren of Toronto.
I do want to give you, in closing, a few observations that I've made about the relationship between the environmental crisis and the financial crisis. First of all, one of the good things to me about the financial crisis is that what it's done is introduced into public discourse this distinction between the financial economy and the real economy. All of my work is on the real economy. By that I mean it's the actual production of and transportation and consumption and disposal of goods and services. And because it's at the, in the real world, in the real economy, that you have all the impacts on the environment. But I think it's fair to say that what's happened in the last number of years or decades is that we have allowed the financial economy to take precedence over the real economy. So we run the real economy in order to achieve financial objectives instead of the other way around. The financial economy should be subservient to the real economy. And as I've already said, and I'm going to keep saying as long as I have breath, is that if we understand the real economy as being a subsystem of the biosphere, then even more should we look to the financial economy to be subservient to the real economy. Now, some commonalities between the financial crisis and the environmental crisis, not really hard to find. First of all, in both arenas, there's weak and often non-existent regulatory oversight, both nationally and internationally. We're only now discovering, perhaps, or recognizing what we lack in the financial world, but those of us who work in the environmental arena know for many years we've lacked proper national and definitely international governance and regulation. Conflict of interest is rampant, and you see this in so many respects. One that always stands out in my mind is who do we turn to advice when we have a crisis, and are their hands clean? And often they're not. We have an inadequate understanding of the systems. Clearly it's coming out. Even the people involved in finance don't seem to understand the financial system. And I don't think we fully understand the environmental systems either. In the financial world, one of the things that's come to light is the inappropriate evaluation of assets. The same thing's happened in the environmental crisis. We don't adequately evaluate the assets on which we, as a biological species, as humans, depend. And so you can see the parallel. Both are obstacles to us solving the problems. We don't understand and don't appreciate the value of the assets we have. In both arenas, financial and environmental, we suffer from inadequate information. And what does that mean? It means that when we come to assess the risks, we don't do it properly. Very poor assessment of risk and people make bad decisions. We see this very clearly in the environmental world. Now we're seeing it in the financial world. If there's one possibly positive outcome of all this, is that what we see is that in times of crisis, ideas do change and people do change positions in a way that you don't see when one day seems rather like the next. My concern right now is that we will fix the financial crisis at the expense of the environment. In other words, we'll shift priorities even further away from addressing our environmental concerns, and we will pay the price in the future for having done so. And I'm hoping, and you'll be the judge, that my book, Managing Without Growth, offers us some ideas for heading off in a different and better direction. Thank you very much.
That is Toronto economist Peter Victor at his launch of the book, Managing Without Growth, Slower by Design, Not Disaster. just this past November 18th. The book describes an economy that does not depend on growth. Imagine that. It doesn't need unreasonable demands for endless growth, which is killing off, well, the capitalist economy and the planet, it appears. The launch was attended by famed environmentalist and broadcaster Dr. David Suzuki and Toronto Mayor David Miller. In one important development at that launch, Mayor Miller described his city's project to reclad tower buildings. These were built in the days of cheap oil with little thought for energy efficiency in either heating or cooling. Now the big towers need retrofitting all over the world to survive as oil and natural gas go into decline. There is a project sure to generate new jobs without the crazy idea of a whole new building binge. Peter Victor is a professor of environmental studies at York University in Canada. Find out more about this important book at managingwithoutgrowth.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, how may I ask you please to return to your seat now and securely fasten your seatbelt. Please ensure the table in front of you has been folded away. Your seatbelt should be upright with the armrests down. We would also ask now that all electronic equipment be switched off and properly and safely stowed for our landing. One further reminder that mobile phones must not be switched on until the aircraft is on stand and the engines have been shut down. Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Let's get to the big man, Barack Obama. Here is the message Obama sent to the Governor's Conference in Beverly Hills, called by California Schwarzenegger for November 18th.
Let me begin by thanking the bipartisan group of U.S. governors who convened this meeting. Few challenges facing America and the world are more urgent than combating climate change. The science is beyond dispute, and the facts are clear. Sea levels are rising. Coastlines are shrinking. We've seen record drought, spreading famine, and storms that are growing stronger with each passing hurricane season. Climate change and our dependence on foreign oil, if left unaddressed, will continue to weaken our economy and threaten our national security. I know many of you are working to confront this challenge. In particular, I want to commend Governor Sebelius, Governor Doyle, Governor Crist, Governor Blagojevich, and your host, Governor Schwarzenegger. All of you have shown true leadership in the fight to combat global warming. And we've also seen a number of businesses doing their part by investing in clean energy technologies. But too often, Washington has failed to show the same kind of leadership. That will change when I take office. My presidency will mark a new chapter in America's leadership on climate change that will strengthen our security and create millions of new jobs in the process. That will start with a federal cap and trade system. We'll establish strong annual targets that set us on a course to reduce emissions to their 1990 levels by 2020 and reduce them an additional 80% by 2050. Further, we'll invest $15 billion each year to catalyze private sector efforts to build a clean energy future. We'll invest in solar power, wind power, and next generation biofuels. We'll tap nuclear power while making sure it's safe, and we will develop clean coal technologies. This investment will not only help us reduce our dependence on foreign oil, making the United States more secure, and it will not only help us bring about a clean energy future, saving the planet, it will also help us transform our industries and steer our country out of this economic crisis by generating 5 million new green jobs that pay well and can't be outsourced. The truth is, the United States can't meet this challenge alone. Solving this problem will require all of us working together. I understand that your meeting is being attended by government officials from over a dozen countries, including the UK, Canada, Mexico, Brazil, and Chile, Poland, and Australia, India, and Indonesia. And I look forward to working with all nations to meet this challenge in the coming years. Let me also say a special word to the delegates from around the world who will gather at Poland next month. Your work is vital to the planet. While I won't be president at the time of your meeting, and while the United States has only one president at a time, I've asked members of Congress who are attending the conference as observers to report back to me on what they learned there. And once I take office, you can be sure that the United States will once again engage vigorously in these negotiations and help lead the world toward a new era of global cooperation on climate change. Now's the time to confront this challenge once and for all. Delay is no longer an option. Denial is no longer an acceptable response. The stakes are too high. The consequences too serious. Stopping climate change won't be easy. It won't happen overnight. But I promise you this. When I am president, any governor who's willing to promote clean energy will have a partner in the White House. Any company that's willing to invest in clean energy will have an ally in Washington. And any nation that's willing to join the cause of combating climate change will have an ally in the United States of America. Thank you.
Actually, it was an international affair, and finally, an American president-to-be offered us all some hope about the climate. It's been 20 years coming, but America is going to join the world in a fight to save the climate. Of course, the Hackney's journalist friend, too little, too late, just doesn't make it now. When physics rules the climate system, we need everything Obama promised and a whole lot more to save what's left of the playpen, my friends. There is an even better vision of a new green economy from Robert Polen. Here's a quick snapshot of Polen from the progressive radio program Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. If it's green, the payoff will be greatest. But what does a green stimulus look like?
And should there be an auto industry bailout? We're joined by Robert Polen, economics professor and founding co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts and co-author of Green Recovery, a program to create good jobs and start building a low-carbon economy.
Now I want to move into the idea of a green stimulus, and that is something that you have been professing for a long time. I wonder if you can explain what that would entail and how it might be implemented and how that would help end the recession?
We need to fight global warming. The question is getting there and putting in the resources and focusing a program to get us there. So a green stimulus, is the way I've outlined it, would include some short-term features and some long-term features. The short-term features would be measures to increase energy efficiency. Making more energy-efficient cars is one part of it, but the ones that I've really highlighted are ones that would create a lot of jobs. One would be investing in building retrofits to make the building stock of the U.S. more energy efficient. In that case, we know there is a lot of certainty there. You put money in, you can, for pretty low investments, you can get high returns. You can lower energy costs by a third through relatively low investments in tightening up buildings, putting in insulation, caulking, fairly simple things that are not in any way high tech. Another simple thing is simply to improve public transportation. Hire more bus drivers. Get people into public transportation. That's a big job program, and it would reduce greenhouse gas emissions and fight global warming. Those things can be done right now, immediately, and then have a big impact. Beyond that, transition to renewable energy sources right now, that is at largely the stage of research, development, and moving towards commercialization, and that should be subsidized. Because right now, of course, fossil fuel companies, oil, gas, coal, they don't pay for emitting greenhouse gases into the environment. So we are, in a sense, massively subsidizing the destruction of our environment through allowing them to emit greenhouse gases. What we need to do instead is subsidize renewable energy. Now, putting all these things together, it happens to have the effect, not because it's green, but because of the nature of the investments, it creates a lot of jobs. Putting money into building retrofits creates about three times or four times the number of jobs as spending in fossil fuel. That's because they're more labor intensive, it requires more people, and because the domestic content is higher. That is, creating jobs in the U.S. as opposed to in other countries. Once we start investing in the green economy, we also automatically have a jobs program. So I think that is a really major combination a confluence of benefits that we need to exploit.
Now, Obama has come out in favor of this, but I don't think to the extent that you're proposing. What kind of numbers are you talking about, and what kind of numbers has Obama so far proposed?
Well, Obama's numbers are not realistic. Presidential campaigns are not the place to work out serious economic matters. In any case, the Obama's campaign program was not really a serious program. His program was to create 5 million jobs in 10 years through a total spending of $150 billion a year. Well, that sounds like really big numbers, but it's actually peanuts. $15 billion a year in today's economy is 0.1% of total GDP. Nothing much is going to change. I've proposed something on the order of 10 times that size, $150 billion per year, and I've tried to show how to finance it. Even that is not especially large, but right now we spend about $600 billion a year on fossil fuels. So imagine converting about 25% of that spending, shifting it into building retrofits, into public transportation, into tightening up our electrical grid system, and subsidizing renewable energy. And in 10 years, we could probably get fossil fuel consumption down by 30 or 40%. In 20 years, we can have a renewable energy economy and create more jobs in the process. I think it is a really viable program. It works in the long term. It also works very much as a stimulus program for the short term.
And I'm sure many of our listeners would love a copy of Green Recovery, a program to create good jobs and start building a low-carbon economy. How can we get that?
All you have to do is go to Google and type in Green Recovery, and you can either get it at the website of the Center for American Progress that was nice enough to sponsor our work, or my own institute, Political Economy Research Institute. It's out there. It's getting a lot of attention, a lot more than I had ever dreamed. I'm glad of that. At the same time, the interesting thing is at the time that we published it, which was only 2 months ago, it seemed like a huge, audacious program. Right now, it seems like something rather puny, given this magnitude of the crisis that we're facing.
Well, we'll look at part one and then wait for part two to match the catastrophic proportions of the recession. Bob, thank you so much. And we have been speaking with Bob Pullen, who is always on the case and understands what it means to create a green recovery program.
You've just heard from Building Bridges on WBAI. Check out buildingbridgesonline.org for more people-friendly news and interviews. It's a good show. Right now, you are tuned to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, saying, get over that short buzz, that Obama thing. It's time already to... As the Bush administration moves out, they're trying to extend their range of climate sabotage even further into the future. On behalf of every Texas oil man and billionaire the president ever worked for, well, British columnist and activist George Monbiot describes the scene in a must-read article from the Guardian newspaper, November 25, 2008. It's called One Shot Left. George Bush is behaving like a furious defaulter whose home is about to be repossessed. Smashing the porcelain, ripping the doors off the hinges, he is determined that there will be nothing worth owning by the time the bastards kick him out, his midnight regulations opening America's wilderness to logging and mining, trashing pollution controls, tearing up conservation laws, will do almost as much damage in the last 60 days of his presidency as he achieved in the foregoing 300 days. His backers, among them the nastiest plutocrats in America, are calling in their favors. But this last binge of vandalism is also the Bush presidency reduced to its essentials. Destruction is not an accidental product of its ideology. Destruction is the ideology. Neoconservatism is power expressed by showing that you can reduce any part of the world to rubble. If it is now too late to prevent runaway climate change, the Bush team must carry much of the blame. His willful trashing of the middle climate, the interlude of benign temperatures which allowed human civilization to flourish, makes the mass murder he engineered in Iraq only the second of his crimes against humanity. Bush has waged his war on science with the same obtuse determination with which he has waged his war on terror. Is it too late? To say so is to make it true. To suggest that there is nothing that can be done now is to ensure that nothing is done. But even a resolute optimist like me finds hope ever harder to summon. A new summary of the science published since last year's Intergovernmental Panel report suggests that, almost a century ahead of schedule, the critical climate processes might have begun. Just a year ago, the Intergovernmental Panel warned that the Arctic's late summer sea ice is projected to disappear almost completely towards the end of the 21st century in some models. But as the new report by the Public Interest Research Center, PIRC, shows, climate scientists are now predicting the end of late summer sea ice within 3 to 7 years. The trajectory of current melting plummets through the graphs like a meteorite falling to Earth. Forget the sodding polar bears. This is about all of us. As the ice disappears, the region becomes darker, which means it absorbs more heat. A recent paper published in Geophysical Research Letters shows that the extra warming caused by disappearing sea ice penetrates 1,500 kilometers inland, covering almost the entire region of continuous permafrost. Arctic permafrost contains twice as much carbon as the entire global atmosphere. It remains safe for as long as the ground stays frozen. But the melting has begun. Methane gushers are now gassing out of some places with such force that they keep the water open in Arctic lakes through the winter. The effects of melting permafrost are not incorporated into any global climate models. Runaway warming in the Arctic alone could flip the entire planet into a new climatic state. The middle climate could collapse faster and sooner than the grimmest forecasts proposed. Barack Obama's speech to the U.S. Climate Summit last week was an astonishing development. It shows that, in this respect at least, there really is a prospect of profound political change in America. But while he described a workable plan for dealing with the problem perceived by the Earth Summit of 1992, the measures he proposes are now hopelessly out of date. The science has moved on. The events the Earth Summit and the Kyoto Process were supposed to have prevented are already beginning. Thanks to the wrecking tactics of Bush the Elder, Clinton and Gore, and Bush the Younger, steady, sensible programs of the kind that Obama proposes are now irrelevant. As the PIRC report suggests, the years of sabotage and procrastination have left us with only one remaining shot, a crash program of total energy replacement. That is from George Monbiot in the UK's Guardian newspaper, November 25th. Read that. George has been a guest on Radio EcoShock just 2 months ago, and he goes on with the science complete with footnotes showing we need to cut our emissions by a staggering 8% a year, starting right about now.
Hello? This is your captain speaking. There is absolutely no cause for alarm.
I'll get them thinking.
No, I'm not yet.
Let it sink in. They're thinking, what is there absolutely no cause for alarm about? Are the wings on fire?
The wings are not on fire.
Now they're thinking, why should he say that? So we...
He also notes the final irony. We've already spent over $8 trillion saving the banks. Will there be anything left to switch off fossil fuels?
They say, steal the bird by way.
Finden Sie das absurd? Nun, genauso absurd ist es, sich nicht anzugurten, weil man nur eine kurze Strecke fährt. Ein Band fürs Leben.
You've hit the Fasten Your Seatbelts edition of Radio EcoShock. After 30 seconds of mayhem from Pendulum, we'll be right back with the truth about carbon and the latest testimony by NASA's James Hansen, this time to the British government.
Sound. You're too young, you need a song.
Welcome to the Radio EcoShock Show with Alex Smith. We're heading for a fast gulp of the most recent testimony by Dr. James Hansen on why the climate won't wait, no matter what the economy is doing. Think about it. Where does the gas in your tank go? Into the air. How long does it stay there? Some serious scientists say we may already be too late. The carbon is up there, and some of it will last virtually forever in human terms. The truth about carbon is reported in the November 20th edition of Nature magazine. A University of Chicago oceanographer, David Archer, along with his team, tested how long carbon emissions lasted up there in the sky. Archer's new book is The Long Thaw. He tells Nature magazine, quote, "The lifetime of fossil fuel, CO2 in the atmosphere, is a few centuries, plus 25% that lasts essentially forever. The next time you fill your tank, reflect upon this." In his book, Archer writes, "The climatic impacts of releasing fossil fuel CO2 to the atmosphere will last longer than Stonehenge, longer than time capsules, longer than nuclear waste, far longer than the age of human civilization so far." That was David Archer. His new book is The Long Thaw. Even worse, our master plan to convert away from fossil fuels may tip the planet into horrible heating anyway. That's the worry from author and blogger Sharon Ask in a controversial article titled "A New Deal or a War Footing? Thinking Through Our Response to Climate Change." Sharon takes apart the new energy program proposed by Al Gore in the New York Times on November 9th. She counts up the carbon costs of building the new solar plants, wind farms, the new power grid for America, converting our rolling stock to electric, and retrofitting all our buildings. The only thing Gore doesn't mention is changing our wasteful lifestyles. Just like the free money Paulson pulls out of a hat, we developed people don't have to give up a thing. We'll just build our way out of it. We're so smart, using our fossil-powered machinery and more gigatons of carboniferous cement and steel. Just the urge to save ourselves, technically, will generate more new greenhouse gases than the atmosphere can withstand, says Sharon Astick. That's spelled A-S-T-Y-K. And she says the better alternative is to cut our own energy consumption now by at least 50%, whatever that takes. Whatever it takes. Too much? Time for a Monty Python break. Don't forget, more hope and tragedy coming right up with NASA's James Hansen.
But do not leave your seats.
Do not panic.
Tea will now be served.
Inflate your life jackets.
And extinguish all cigarettes.
Please remove the luggage from the racks above your heads and place it on the racks on the other side of the aircraft.
Except the hand luggage.
Which you should sit on.
Now have a look.
Hang on.
What?
Hang on.
What?
They've all jumped out.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if there wasn't some trouble about this.
There may be no going back. But one of our best, most honest scientists, Dr. James Hansen of the Goddard Institute in NASA, says it ain't so. Yes, we are past the danger point on greenhouse gases. But no, the situation isn't hopeless. We can retrieve the climate and even re-ice the Arctic, he says, if humans can reverse the carbon flow. We need to end our dependence on fossil fuels, especially coal, and start a new economy of taking carbon out of the air. The last-ditch effort to save our climate is described by Dr. Hansen and Tim Helwig Larson, director of Public Interest Research Center, a small British think tank. They testified to the British Government Environmental Audit Committee on November 26, 2008, for about an hour. I've recorded this landmark testimony for you, crammed with the newest outlook on our climate from the government's ParliamentLive.tv site. In this program, I'll cram the highlights into 22 minutes. You can download the whole thing as a free MP3 from the climate change page of our website, ecoshock.org. Here we go.
at this point. Your question is, what is some of the most concerning recent evidence? And obviously we've had the IPCC's fourth assessment report last year in 2007. What have we seen since then? And the question, I think, might also be asked, what have we seen since the deadline for submissions into the IPCC process, which was a year or more in advance of that? And I think one of the pieces of work which Dr. Hansen has been exploring, which is of particular concern to us, is the situation in the Arctic, that really we are facing a very dramatic change in the sea ice, the ice that floats on the ocean at the top of the Arctic. It's melting away much faster than we thought. And there is really three things coming out of this. We're seeing extra heating, extra greenhouse gas release, and extra sea level rise. And the reason that this comes about is that the first element of it is quite intuitive. If you think of the very vast area of white reflective material at the top of our planet, during the Arctic summer, when it's pointed more towards the sun, that is providing a huge parasol effect to the Earth. And as that melts away, and it has been dramatically, we see that last year the extent of the Arctic was reduced by some 40%, I believe, and the actual volume of the sea ice, which is perhaps the more crucial measure, had dropped by to just 30%. So it had dropped by a full 70% since the year 1979. Now, with the Arctic melting away at that rate, it causes a regional warming, and that regional warming extends inland into Siberia and Alaska. It extends inland some 1,500 kilometres. Now that brings us to, if you like, the second melt, because this is really the story of a triple melt, that the melting Arctic sea ice leads to increased temperatures on land, and we know that there are absolutely vast stocks of carbon locked up in the permafrost in Siberia and in the Arctic Circle. So these huge areas, these huge amounts of carbon are many times larger than our oil and gas reserves, and they are more than twice the size of the carbon that sits in our atmosphere today. And it would only require a small amount of this to completely undermine all of our efforts at decarbonizing energy or transport or emissions from industrial exercises. So that would be the second component of our triple melt, and it leads to increased or extra greenhouse gas emissions over and above those that we were expecting. But the third is that, again, consequent of the melting Arctic sea ice, we will see that 1,500 kilometres of warming going inland will extend over the Greenland ice shelf, the Greenland ice sheet. And we are already seeing a change in dynamic processes of ice melt there, things where the patterns that we haven't yet fully understood, but we can see that the ice is melting much faster than expected. So we've got extra warming, we've got extra greenhouse gas emissions release, and we've got extra sea level rise, all on top of them, all extra and over and above the models that are used in the IPCC's advice to policymakers.
Yep. And the thing is, this melt that he talks about is one of the criteria which helps us estimate what is the dangerous level of atmospheric carbon dioxide. If we wanted to stop further melt of the Arctic ice, we would have to restore the planet's energy balance. Now there's more energy coming in than going out because of the trapping of heat by carbon dioxide. We would have to reduce the CO2 amount less than its present amount to no more than 350 parts per million. But it's not only this melt problem that Tim mentions, but there are other things, one of which is also melt, and that's the mountain glaciers all around the world, which are receding at rapid rates and which provide fresh water during the summer and fall for hundreds of millions of people via the rivers that originate in the Himalayas and the Rockies and the Andes and other mountain ranges. And we're going to lose all of those mountain glaciers within 50 years if we stay on business as usual. What we would need to do, again, is actually reduce the CO2 to less than the 385 and to less than 350 parts per million. There are other things that we see happening now which tell us that already we're getting into the dangerous zone. The expansion of the subtropics, which is affecting the climate in regions such as the southern United States and the Mediterranean region and Australia and parts of Africa, making those regions drier and hotter and increasing forest fires in the western and southern United States and in the Mediterranean region. We already see that expansion has occurred. And there's also evidence of increased stress on coral reefs, which are very important for harboring about one-third of the biological species in the ocean. And they're being stressed by both the acidification of the ocean, which again is a direct effect of CO2. As more CO2 is taken up by the ocean, it becomes more acid, and that affects the life that depends upon, has carbonate shells or carbonate skeletons. And also the increasing ocean temperature is stressing the coral reefs. So again, it tells us we've actually gone somewhat too far at 385 parts per million. And the only way it is actually possible to draw down the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, both as the ocean takes up more of the CO2, and also if we improve our agricultural and forestry practices, we can draw down CO2 by 50 parts per million or so, restoring some of the forests. But we cannot take it down several hundred ppm. So if we burn all the fossil fuels, there's no practical way to get back to 350.
Do you think we should be focusing more on the actual concentration in the atmosphere?
Well, I think you should be focusing on the sources, because and not targets for percent reduction of emissions, but because the lifetime of the CO2 in the atmosphere, a large fraction, more than 1,000 years. So burning it a little bit slower doesn't make much difference. We actually have to look at how much carbon we have in the carbon reservoirs of oil, gas, and coal. And that really tells us that we cannot burn all of the coal. That's the critical thing, and that's the point that I'm trying to stress to people, that we can't say we have some targets in 2050 or 2030 or any time and still build more coal-fired power plants. Because if you do that, there's no way that you're going to prevent getting far into the dangerous zone. You're going to have to stop the coal emissions.
Jim rightly says, if we don't have, if we can't lower concentrations below, reduce the level of the pot below what it is today, we have no confidence that we will have an Arctic left in the future to help maintain the stability of our temperatures and of our planet.
There's more than one tipping point. We have probably reached the tipping point for Arctic sea ice because the planet is out of energy balance. We're probably going to lose the summer sea ice in the Arctic over the next few decades, but that's a reversible tipping point. If you restore the planet's energy balance or make it slightly negative, then the ice will grow back. But the tipping points that we should be most concerned about, in my opinion, are those which are irreversible on any time scale that we can imagine. And that would include disintegration of the large ice sheets, say on West Antarctica or Greenland. If we reach a point where they begin to disintegrate and the dynamics of the process takes over, and that's really what you mean by a tipping point, where the dynamics of the process begins to take over and the positive amplifying feedbacks just drive you to a large change. If the ice sheet begins to disintegrate and goes, and the process gets too far, then reducing CO2 is not going to stop it. It'll just continue. I don't think, and tipping points are inherently very hard to quantify when you reach the point of no return, because it's a very nonlinear problem. It's like the economic situation. You can have very bad economic policies and the economy carries on and not much happens, and then finally you get to a point where the thing collapses. But it's very hard to predict what date that's going to happen. But you can predict if you continue negative budget and things, you will eventually get a problem.
You're listening to Dr. James Hansen and Tim Helwig Larson on Radio EcoShock.
So I don't think we've reached that tipping point. The other one that's irreversible is extermination of species. We're putting pressure on animal and plant species because of the rate of the climate change, which is very unusual. A given temperature line is now moving poleward on average at a rate of about 60 kilometers per decade. And for some period of time, the stress that species will try to migrate to stay within the climate zone that they're comfortable in. But once that total distance becomes too large, some species do not migrate easily, and species are interdependent, so that you can eventually get ecosystem collapse. I mean, now we're beginning to put pressure on some species, like polar bear, for example. But you don't want to get to the point where ecosystems begin to collapse. And that, again, it's hard to say, but we're clearly beginning to put stress on species, and there are more extinctions now than is natural.
What is the rate of our decline of our race out of carbon? And what they find through exploring a number of scenarios is that more than half of their scenarios show a decline rate, a descent out of carbon, that they considered to be politically impossible. Now, whether that proves to be the case or not has yet to be seen, but they defined that as an emissions reduction rate of 8% per year over an extended period or more. And the context for this really is that Nicholas Stern has pointed to the fact that there are no situations where any country has moved out of carbon faster than 1% a year for an extended period in a managed way. It's happened in unmanaged ways, and the key example there would be the collapse of the USSR, which saw 5% a year reductions for a continuous period. And if we were trying to look for managed processes, managed examples, we would probably look to the 40-fold increase in nuclear power plants in France over a 25-year period, or perhaps the dash for gas in Britain in the 90s, both of which only delivered a 1% per year cut in carbon emissions. And what we're talking about is 4, 5, 6, 7, 8% a year. And what this crucially means is that we have to bring forward the start of this race out of carbon. Every year that we delay means that the descent out of carbon will finally be steeper. And So it's absolutely incumbent on us to start that exit now. And so what we've been recommending in our climate safety report that we've just produced is that, as well as having long-term targets, as well as cutting out the practices that we just know to be harmful straight off, such as deciding to have no new coal-fired power stations, deciding not to open up any new coal mines, as well as doing those long-term things and those mid-term things, we only have a chance of reaching future stabilization levels of 450, 350 or below if we take action today and start moving on to the road of decarbonization. We should probably be looking to augment these long-term policies with something like a 10% reduction by 2010, which can actually step us onto that path, stop our trajectory from rising and start it declining.
Do you think that the aim of limiting the rise in temperatures to 2 degrees centigrade, is that a safe aim, or does that itself represent a tipping point?
I think that is another thing where our understanding has changed over the last several years. And unfortunately, there was too much of an impression that prior interglacial periods were a few degrees warmer. It turns out, top of the ice sheets where measurements were made, indirect measurements of the temperature at which the snow formed, the temperature was 2 or 3 degrees warmer during the warmest interglacials than it is during the current interglacial. But on the global average, now that we have ocean cores from around most of the global oceans, which also give us a way of inferring what the ocean temperature was, that The warmest interglacials were not more than about 1 degree warmer than the pre-industrial level. So a more appropriate target would have been 1 degree. 2 degrees is very likely to mean that we would not have any sea ice in the Arctic, that we would not have any mountain glaciers. So unfortunately, that target, even though it's considered difficult, is too high. And it's, you know, this very bad news to be giving to governments. But, you know, you can't change the laws of physics. And what is becoming clear is that we're pushing the system beyond a level that would allow us to maintain a planet that looks like the planet that has existed for the last 10 to 12,000 years. The Earth's climate has gone through very large oscillations in the past, and you might say, well, maybe a different climate would be all right, but unfortunately we've set up our civilization and our infrastructure with sea level where it is and with climate zones where they are. And the implications of moving out of this climate, of the recent climate range, would be enormous in terms of, you know, it's happened before, and when it has happened, it's driven more than half the species on the planet to extinction. And over hundreds of thousands of years, you got new species. But that's a time scale which we cannot imagine. You know, it would be generations, any generation that we can think of, it would be a much more desolate planet. Frankly, I do not think that carbon capture and sequestration is likely to play a big role in the future. I think that it will just make coal more expensive and it will become less competitive. But yet, I'd like very much to see that R&D, because that carbon capture and sequestration can be used in combination with biofuels. If you have a power plant that is burning biofuels, then while the plants are growing that you make the biofuels from, they draw the CO2 out of the atmosphere. You burn the biofuels in the power plant, capture the CO2, and sequester it. And that way you can draw down the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere and help us get back below 350. And we're going to realize over the next decade or so, we're going to realize we have to do things like that. And that's a sort of natural geoengineering.
But what we know today is that our climate is changing faster than expected, and we know that the consequences are unmanageable if we let them go too far. So that we know that today that we need to be taking full action to decarbonize our economy, because that is the one lever that we most clearly hold, and that requires us to step off the upward trajectory of carbon emissions onto the downward trajectory. And so I would really encourage a short-term goal that fits with our long-term ambitions, that we make a 10% reduction in the next couple of years, both to demonstrate that we mean what we talk about, but also because we won't be able to meet any long-term objectives unless we have stepped onto that path.
The politics of the system seems to favor short-term over the long-term, and short-term, it's difficult to make the changes which make sense on the long term. And the people who are affected on the long term, the young and the unborn and the nature, don't have much voice in our decisions. That's what, you know, we have to change. And I think young people are beginning to recognize the situation, and we're going to see more and more actions to try to force the political systems to respond for the good of young people and future generations. But so far, the fossil fuel industry has had more influence on our policies than young people have. Because of the long lifetime of CO2, and because CO2 is the dominant issue, we do have to look at where it's coming from and the conclusion that you have to draw is we've got to do something about coal, and we have to also avoid unconventional fossil fuels like tar shale and tar sands, but that goes almost without being said. And maybe, if I could say one more thing, I think that we are going to have to put a price on carbon emissions. And I know that it's a very politically very difficult thing to do. Green taxes are resisted even after, when they get not even very large. So I think, and it may not be a topic for this committee, but I think we have to have a tax and 100% dividend in which the government taxes carbon emissions, but it gives all the money back to the public on a per capita basis. So you get a fair, everyone gets the same share back, but you pay according to what you put into the atmosphere. And if that's recognized, that that tax is going to grow with time, then we would transform society in ways that would allow us to transition to a no-carbon future. And if we don't have that economic incentive, I think it's going to be very hard to do it.
That was a fast boil down from 68 minutes of testimony by NASA's Dr. James Hansen and Tim Helwig Larsen of the UK charity PIRC, delivered to the British Environmental Audit Committee on November 26th. I recorded it from ParliamentLive.tv, and you can download it all from the Climate Change 2008 page of our audio on demand menu at ecoshock.org. It's a free MP3 download. I'm Alex Smith. Next week on Radio EcoShock, we dive into the deep end of the carbon pit. It's the dark side of the tar sands, climate-wrecking, earth-scarring, industrial genocide for your big V8 and your Mideast wars. Next week. Radio EcoShock is broadcast on 15 college and community radio stations, plus satellite, cable, and podcast. Download our past shows at ecoshock.org. And welcome to our new San Francisco listeners over Green 960 AM. Please ask your local radio station to carry this program. Our music core was Fasten Your Seatbelts from Pendulum. We'll follow that theme in our final cut from Laurie Anderson, who just married Lou Reed this April. Until next week, my friends, who knows what wonders will appear by then and how many trillions will disappear.
What do you want in a financial market? Electronic trading 24 hours a day? No commissions and 1% margins? Opportunities in rising and falling markets? Does a market like this really exist?
There is an air of nervousness on Wall Street one day after stocks tumbled to their lowest level in 11 years.
There's just no confidence at all that we're going to ever recover. So it's really a fear. I don't think it's justified by the facts, but it's fear. It's fear selling.
We're not trading on fundamentals. It's just trading on forced liquidation, fear, maybe some panic, what we call forced selling.
What we see in the United States is American-driven news that's shaped around American foreign policy and takes the vantage point of U.S. interests at its core. What we really need is a real independent international media outlet.
Check out Real News at realnews.com.
The U.S. government announced another $800 billion injection on Tuesday in the hopes of bolstering the frozen credit markets and the devastated housing markets. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson announced $200 billion to unfreeze credit for various types of consumer debt. As well, the Federal Reserve will provide $600 billion in funding for new mortgages to help stimulate the U.S. housing market. These recent pledges by the federal government are in addition to the $7.76 trillion already pledged, as tallied in a recent Bloomberg report.
This is your captain. We are going down. We are all going down. Together. And I said, this is gonna be some day. Stand by. Stand by. Put your hand. Lane.